This is a Hawaii Agricultural Foundation podcast for Eat, Think, Drink, Fishing for Answers, Wild and Farmed, presented by Hawaiian Airlines.
Aloha, I'm Denise Yamaguchi, the Executive Director for the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation, and I want to thank all of you for joining us this evening for our seventh episode of Eat, Think, Drink, Fishing for Answers, Wild and Farmed. The Hawaii Agricultural Foundation launched Eat, Think, Drink in November of 2016 in an effort to spark meaningful conversations about important agricultural and food issues facing our community and to build and engage a larger network of conscious and caring consumers like you. Before we start, I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, Hawaiian Airline, and our supporting sponsors, Alexander & Baldwin, Alohilani Resort, Waikiki Beach, Hawaii Crop Improvement Association, Honolulu Magazine and Honolulu Family, Kamehameha Schools, Lend-Lease, the State of Hawaii, and the Ulupono Initiative. Tonight, you will have an opportunity to hear from leaders and innovators of the seafood industry. Our keynote speaker tonight is John Finger, and he is the co-founder and CEO of Hog Island Oyster Company. Tonight, John will share his company's 35-year journey to becoming one of the premier producers of sustainable shellfish. With 160 acres in Tomales Bay, Hog Island raises, harvests, sells more than 3.5 million oysters, manila clams, and mussels each year. The company is part of a global community of B corporations, benefits corporation is what that means, that have been certified to meet rigorous standards of social and environmental performance, accountability, and transparency. After John's keynote, a panel of local industry experts will join John in the conversation. Brooks Takenaka, General Manager of United Fishing Agency, operates the Honolulu Fish Auction, and as an industry veteran, brings his knowledge and expertise from over 40 years of professional experience in Hawaii's fishing and seafood industries. Ron Weidenbach, Manager of Hawaii Fish Company, is Hawaii's oldest land-based family-owned aquaculture farm. Located on the north shore of Oahu, the company's current production focus is on its premium North Shore tilapia, which we will all have a chance to try tonight. Guy Tamashiro is Vice President of Tamashiro Market. I'm sure you all know Tamashiro Market. Well, Guy is always up early in the morning hours to buy fresh local fish at the Honolulu Fish Auction, selecting the finest seafood for his loyal customers who know their fish quality and value. Moderating the panel discussion is Dr. John Kaneko, Program Manager of Hawaii Seafood Council. John has worked in the fishing industry and seafood industry since 1988 and today runs Hawaii Seafood Council, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting Hawaii's responsible fisheries through research, outreach, and training on quality, health benefits, seafood safety, and sustainability. Now please join me in welcoming John Finger, co-founder and CEO of Hog Island Oyster Company.
Good evening. First, I wanted to say thanks to Denise and Allison and the Hawaii Agriculture Foundation for inviting me over here to share my story and my thoughts on sustainable seafood. Get this going here. Back up a second. So, the ocean and fishing has always been in my blood. This is me. I think I was 9 or 10 years old, the first striped bass I ever caught. I grew up on the East End, Long Island, in New York. People know much about that. And when I was growing up, it was very rural, potato farms, and we were constantly fishing and hunting, clamming. I don't think I ever bought fish in a store until after college. It was the first time I ever did that. So I got very interested in that, went to school for marine biology back in New York as well. And while I was there, we'd always been into food, and I just really wanted to link the two of them together. So I really studied fisheries biology, and in doing so and knowing what was going on, thought at that point in time the fisheries of the world were going to have a hard time keeping up, and that aquaculture was the wave of the future. And that's what I really wanted to do, and except I was going to raise fish. I never ate oysters raw, cooked or otherwise. They were the only seafood I didn't eat, and, I'm not quite sure how I made it to this place, but that was the journey. So I had done an internship in California during college and thought as a surfer that would be a fun place to live for a few years. That was 1979. And started knocking on doors. The plan was, and I probably got this backwards, the plan was my buddy and I were going to drive through California knocking on doors for anybody who was doing any kind of aquaculture, fish or shellfish farming, and then continue to Oregon, to Washington. And if we hadn't gotten any jobs, we were going to sell the truck and come to Hawaii. And after this week and enjoying the weather here, and it's a report of hail this morning and 50-degree water, I'm beginning to think I got that backwards. So anyhow, I got a job in the Monterey Bay Area for a shellfish farm, and I fell in love with the shellfish business, primarily because of the environmental sensitivity of it all. I mean, oysters really are about place more than any other food that I know of that you can grow. I mean, we're not feeding, fertilizing, doing all those things. It's really about a healthy, functioning estuary, and oysters actually being part of that healthy, functioning estuary. So, you know, we talk about sustainability a lot, you know, and there's lots of different ways to define that, but I look at it in terms of low or very, very low inputs, and then also just very, very high biodiversity. We've had students come in the summertime with a 100-micron mesh bag around a bag of our oysters and count 100 species of flora and fauna in one bag of oysters. So that's the kind of stuff that really drew me to what I did. In the meantime, I went over and did a little bit of work in Ireland and Spain, saw what was happening in Europe, decided to start my own farm, and came back and started Hagan Oyster Company in 1983 in Tamales Bay, which is about an hour, hour and a half north of San Francisco. We started off with 5 acres. You had to start off small back then in terms of getting acreage. And you lease acreage from the state. And our beginning years was focused primarily just on farming and then selling through wholesalers and distributors to restaurants. And we started off growing Pacific oysters, which back then the prevailing wisdom was is Pacific oysters couldn't be sold as a premium half-shell product, but it was mainly because of the way they were grown. And I had seen things in Europe that led me to, am I leaning on something here? Wow, we went through everything. Technology getting the best. Oh, the other way. Okay, take this thing out of this guy's hand. Wow. Well, now you saw the whole slideshow. I'm done. So. So the prevailing wisdom at the time was Pacific oysters were these large oysters that were for frying or barbecue, and you wouldn't really eat them raw. And so we had a little bit of an uphill battle at the time convincing people that no, because of these growing methods, what you call the single seed method, that we could produce a nice small oyster that was suitable for eating raw in a half shell. Luckily for us, it was right time, right place, the sort of California food movement. Our first two accounts were Chez Panisse and Zuni Cafe. And we did a simple thing. We asked them to put them on the menu as Hog Islands, and next thing we knew, we had food writers coming to talk to us, and we started establishing our brand. And then we grow oysters primarily what's called a rack and bag method, which is a French method, which you can see in the lower right-hand corner there. Gets the oysters up off the bottom, keeps them clean, gets a lot more water flow going by them. Over the years, we grew from that 5 acres to 160 acres, as Denise said, in 4 different places in Tamales Bay. Let me get this thing out of my hands. This is a view of our largest lease at the very north end of the bay. You can see the rows of racks there. And you can also see that most everything we do is intertidal. So we have about a 6 or 7 foot tide range there. So we like the oysters to be out of the water a little bit every day. That conditions them and gets them used to closing up against the air, which is important when you're selling oysters live in the shell. And so this is a low tide on one of our leases. Over the years, we use a few different methods. In the lower right-hand corner, you can see, I didn't do anything that time. Wow. In the lower right-hand corner is our bottom bags, where the bottom is hard enough. You can, are you doing this to me? bottom bags, where the bottom is hard enough to grow oysters on the bottom. You can see the rack and bag culture in the middle. The upper left shows you tipping bags, which is a Methodist gaining popularity, where you attach a float to the bag, and the bag tips with every tidal cycle, which tumbles the oysters, makes a nice polished round shell. All these things, you know, help you produce a better oyster. But getting back to again, what I love about it is, and what I tell people is, 75% of the business is site selection. Even with all these methods, you really need to have a good place to grow the oysters and to know what a good place looks like and the water flow and the patterns and the tides. So, so you know, the company grew. We did fairly well in terms of establishing our brand. Probably didn't do real great financially. It's a struggle in the Bay Area to make a living farming. Sort of by chance, one of the things we developed is a wet storage system. So now all our oysters, and this started in the late 80s, go into filtered seawater tanks before we sell them. It would allow us to add to our quality assurance. These tanks are UV sterilized. We chill the seawater down. We can hold the oysters in there for 24 hours before we sell them. When we did that, we said, gee, we have oysters live in tanks here. We can open the gates up to people and sell oysters. We're right on Highway 1. We did that, and we had some customers ask us, gee, it'd be great if we... if you guys added some tables out here and gave us some knives and gloves. And so we did that. And then so we had some other people ask if we could add barbecues in there and they could grill their own oysters. Man, oh, man. And so we did that, too. And then, boom, this whole thing took off to the point where in 2003, half our revenue was coming from people stopping at the farm here. And through that as well, we realized we had the opportunity and responsibility to educate people about what we were doing. So we started doing tours with school groups and culinary groups, and this became something that really we thought was really important to educate people about why it's important that you have bays in this country where you can grow oysters still and what it is like to farm oysters as opposed to wild harvest. So that grew today. Now, if you want to come in any time between April and October and get a table here to barbecue your own oysters, you better reserve it 4 months out. So just wanted, you know, who would have known back then? So anyhow, all along we knew we wanted to maybe do a restaurant along the way. And so in late 2003, we opened our first restaurant in a Ferry Building in San Francisco. It started off small, 1,000 square feet. That restaurant, by the time we stopped and remodeled it in 2014, was going through 1 million oysters. We remodeled it in 2014 and doubled the size, and we go through about 2 million oysters a year at this place. In late 2008, we opened our second restaurant in downtown Napa in the Oxbow Public Market. Oop. And oh, I think I'm ready for this one. And then just recently, we opened, wow. Yeah, I'll keep on going back and forth if people don't mind. We'll work it out. So in March of this year, we opened up Tony Seafood Restaurant, which is down the street from the farm. And this was a 70-year-old, three-generation seafood restaurant that took us about 14 months to remodel because it's built out over the water. And this would be real interesting in sort of a Northern California seafood restaurant. And then coming up, we have one more restaurant planned in the fall of this year in Southern Marin in Larkspur Landing, or what's called Marin Country Mart. So with all that, currently, we, as Denise says, we produce about 3 to 3.5 million oysters a year in Tamales Bay. We sell company-wide about 6 million oysters. So we're always looking to grow more oysters and to have another farm. I'll also mention that in addition to that, we buy, you know, somewhere between, you know, $600,000 and $750,000 worth of fish mainly from local fishermen. So we get very involved in where our fish comes from as well. So I think in 2014, as I said, we were looking at wanting more oysters, and we wanted to start another farm up in Humboldt Bay, which is about 5 hours to the north. At the same time, there were a lot of issues with the supply of oyster seed. All our seed for oyster farms on the West Coast comes from hatcheries, and hatcheries began having problems producing enough seed. So and I'll get back to why that is. It has something to do with changing ocean conditions. But we decided to invest in a hatchery and nursery and another oyster farm. So we have both a hatchery, which is on land, it's an 11,000 square foot building, and a nursery, which is these big long rafts that you see to the lower right here, where we can produce oyster seed anywhere from a quarter inch up to 3/4 inch or 1 inch. And we take about half of that and run it down to our farm, and the other half of it we sell to growers up in Washington State that we then turn around and buy a lot of those shellfish back. So, but you know, we really felt like this investment, which was multi-million dollars, was important because we needed to be able to breed better oysters. And we actually work, you know, with researchers over here at the University of Hawaii with Dr. Maria Hawes over in Hilo, working and trying to breed oysters that can withstand some of the changing ocean conditions we're seeing and some of the diseases we're seeing. As Denise mentioned, we are a certified B Corp, and B is short for Benefit Corporation. It's a certification program, again, based on environmental, community, employee, and people. And, you know, we decided to do this because it's funny. We never really wanted to have a large company. But we grew to, we're over 250 employees today. We have over 100 shareholders. And we felt that the things that were important to us, a healthy environment, the people who work for us, the vendors we deal with, the communities we work in, and having fun, were important to us. And all of a sudden, it's like, gee, we're getting a little bit older here, and we want to make sure this continues on. And this is a way of sort of baking in those values into our corporate DNA. So this had to go through a shareholder vote. So the thing about the B Corp movement that's sort of interesting is it's one, it's a certification, like a lot of the certifications out there. But behind it all is a movement to have a different type of corporation. So there are now 35 states that have a legal benefit corp designation. And so we put that to the vote of our shareholders. That was a unanimous vote. You needed over 2/3 of a vote. And we are now a certified B Corp and a legal California benefit corporation. And again, we felt that was something that was important to keep us on track to be this kind of company for another 35 years or 50 years or whatever. So getting back to my comment about changing ocean conditions. So, you know, I mentioned a while ago that hatcheries were having some problems back in the mid-2000s producing seed. And the one thing we talk a lot about with growing shellfish is shellfish, for a lot of reasons, are canaries in the coal mine. Right? You need clean water if you're going to grow shellfish that is safe to eat, right? You need a healthy bay in terms of all the conditions that need to be there, the biology that needs to be there to grow shellfish. Well, you also need healthy ocean chemistry. And what we started seeing in the mid-2000s, first people thought it had something to do with bacterial contaminations in hatcheries, but then they realized the issue was around ocean chemistry changes that had to do with some of our upwelling events that happened on the West Coast. So everybody knows about upwelling and very good nutrient-rich water. Well, that water is acidic as well. Acidic water, what happens when the water is acidic is calcium carbonate, which is what shell-forming creatures need to form shells, comes out of saturation. That really wasn't a problem in the past because that would mix with surface water and the pH would be okay, and everything that needed to form a shell would be okay. But I don't know if you guys remember looking at the watching The Inconvenient Truth all those years back. When I saw this CO2 graph, I said, wow, we're in a lot of trouble. Because the one thing you have to admit is we are embarking on a huge chemistry experiment. When you're pumping this much CO2 into the atmosphere, a third of it's going into our surface water. We are changing ocean chemistry. And what we were seeing in some of these hatcheries is that calcium carbonate was coming out of saturation. Those larvae, which need to form their first shell, were struggling to do that and using up too much energy and becoming susceptible to bacterial contaminations. We now, with the help of NOAA, have real-time monitoring up and down the West Coast. We have actually two stations at our two sites in Tomales and Humboldt Bay to actually real-time monitor water conditions to know if we need to buffer seawater, to know if we need to shut off our intakes so the larvae can form that shell. Right now, it's only affecting our larvae. It's not affecting older animals, but it's something we are concerned about. So a couple of years ago, a few of us formed what we call the Shellfish Growers Climate Coalition. And we sought help from the Nature Conservancy. And this is sort of our mantra here. We believe we need to do things to ensure a low-carbon future because we are already seeing changes to our ocean. And by the way, this is not just for shellfish. People have heard about corals or other marine life at the base of the food chain, which is very important for a lot of fish as well, which need calcium carbonate and need, you know, a stable ocean chemistry. So you can look this up under the Nature Conservancy. I think we now have about 25 members on both coasts of the United States. So that all leads up to what I want to talk about next, which is, I'm going to go through a group of slides here, and these are not mine, actually. This is Professor Steve Gaines from University of California, Santa Barbara, the Bren School of the Environment, and talking about where our food's going to come from in the future. Whoop. Did it again. So this is the projected growth of protein consumption by the year 2050. And I want to point something out, too, by the way, here. Okay. When you look currently at fish and seafood in the world, where it's coming from, right, it's about equal, fished and farmed. So when we talk about wild versus farmed, it's not an either-or conversation. This is a yes-and conversation. Okay. We need to be thinking about ways that we do both of these, and I'll get into that as we go through the slideshow. So anyhow, you can see where our protein's coming from and how much more needs to be produced if we're going to keep up. So when you look at, again, getting back to what I'm concerned about in CO2 in the atmosphere, you look at the potential of these different sources. And these bar graphs show the lower ones would be sort of best case scenario and the upper ones are average in terms of how much kilogram for CO2 of kilogram of protein you're producing. And if you look, both aquaculture and fishery show up on the lower scale here. So that's where I want to start from, and hopefully we can talk about this more as we get into our panel. And then I can specifically look at when you want to look at greenhouse gas emissions, again, for different food types. Did I just skip a slide? And you look again, you know, at our a lot of our land base, you know, getting down in the fish aquaculture and actually into kelp and different types. Again, we look really, really good. If we want to produce more food, producing more food from the sea or from aquaculture makes a lot of sense. Again, here, you know, and shellfish would be down around unfed aquaculture down there. So. And one of the other things I look at, and it's very important in California, is not just the greenhouse gas emissions, but I'm looking at our fresh water use as well. One of the other things we want to look at is just area used, right? There's been a lot of studies have shown that it would not take much surface area in our oceans or our coastal waters to grow, you know, all the seafood we would need. You know, this it doesn't take up as much as land as we need to produce on land. So anyhow, I just wanted to sort of tee that up a little bit, you know, and getting ready for our panel discussion. You know, a lot of times people ask me, you know, it's confusing. How do we know what's good, what's bad, whether it's fished, whether it's farmed? And really, I'll start off by saying it's not good to generalize. There are always exceptions to every rule. But, you know, one person put it to me, like, it's sort of like the four S's. If you think about whether it's fished or whether it's farmed, you know, of course, lower on the food chain is going to be a little bit easier to do sustainably, right? But you think about small fish, silver, shellfish, seaweeds. Those are all things that are going to be easier, especially as we're looking at farming species. And again, there are exceptions. I always say no absolutes. There are lots of small fisheries the hook and line fisheries for lots of different types of fish that are managed sustainably, and I think we're going to talk about that here a little bit. But I think in general we really need to look to the seas to get more food. So thank you very much.
This is a big group out here, isn't it?
Hey, so I just want to tell you a story. Once upon a time, eating seafood was so easy. You just see the food and you eat. But nowadays, it seems like eating is can become a statement that we're making, and we do need to be cognizant of the impacts of what we do as consumers. So today, many of us are disconnected from our food sources, our farmers, and our fishermen. We struggle to find out how to be responsible consumers, or worse, we don't even care where our food comes from. The seafood industry in the United States comes from wild and farm-raised sources as live fish, fresh, frozen, and value-added seafood products. Over 90% of the seafood in the United States is imported. So we are trying to protect our domestic production, and that goes for our fish farmers and also for our fishermen. And this is why it's getting so confusing. So tonight's battle is here to help us learn a little bit about wild and farm-raised seafood and why knowing where your seafood comes from is so important. So what we want is sustainable seafood produced by responsible fishermen and also growers. For fishermen, this means following regulations that control overfishing and environmental impacts. For farmers, it's primarily in controlling environmental impacts because there are no controls or government controls on how much you can produce. John Finger's Hog Island Oyster Company is a prime example of aquaculture operations that are completely dependent on maintaining good quality of the water in order to produce their shellfish. And now let's find out more from the panel. So I'm going to ask questions of the group in sequence, and I'll ask questions of Brooks first. So Brooks, can you tell us a little bit about the primary source of fish that is sold at the Honolulu Fish Auction?
Yeah, the majority of our fish really are the pelagic or open ocean species. And this basically is, you're speaking about the tunas, the big eye tuna, in particular the yellowfin, the marlins, opa, manchong, and other species, mahi-mahi as an example. And the primary source is really our longline fishing industry. This is the commercial longline fleet that brings in anywhere from about 25 million to about 30 million pounds of fish through the auction every year. And we do not sell imported species or fish.
What about any farm-raised fish?
We do occasionally sell farm-raised fish in support of our local farmers, but that's on a rare occasion. For the most part, it's pretty much wild fish.
Okay. And then how does the fish auction work with the local fishermen to help them become or be responsible operators?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, fishing today is no longer the same. It's not just a matter of going out and catching fish and bringing it back and selling it. We have to be far more responsible. So as an example, as first receivers of these fish, we've got to be responsible and make sure that these fish are wholesome for sale and consumption. And all of this is based on science. So from the get-go, in terms of food safety, in terms of managing our efforts, all along the way, we are producing data and information, working together with our government organizations and the scientists to make sure that we're doing things the right way for the right reasons.
So could you expand on that a little bit? How do you what government agencies you were talking about?
Well, to begin with, the FDA for food safety. So, as first receivers, we make sure that it's fit for sale and consumption. We also work with the National Marine Fisheries Service and the state of Hawaii. So as an example, all our daily market sales data is channeled into the state and the federal government system. So it's an active exchange of information. We also gather data with the fishing vessels and provide that to the government programs as well. So documenting all our information, there's an issue with respect to transparency and tracking of product. I can assure you that our system here in Hawaii has, since its inception, has always addressed those concerns. So we know when the boat and where the boat is fishing, when it sets line, when it comes back, when we sell the fish, and who we sell it to, and price and everything else. So all this data is collected and put together and analyzed by a number of different scientists and government people.
So what you're saying is we have a full counting of the fish harvest, how much the catch is, and we're able to accurately fish within our quotas and control overfishing.
By all means. It really starts with a commitment on the part of our government. And with this, you have the ability to develop rules and regulations. So the science is important. The science then is passed on to the regulators, who then determine what the rules and regulations are. And then within the system itself, the U.S. Coast Guard, Customs and Border Patrol, all of these organizations play a significant role in making sure that we're doing things the right way for the right reasons.
So is that, do you think that that's a distinction, that we are able to accurately count fish and weigh fish and control overfishing against other fisheries that are fishing operations that are out in the Pacific here?
Well, excuse me. I think there's this issue of illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing that's a big issue today. If you think about it, any system that produces a lot of product needs a significant processing as a part of this. And so how do you afford to do this? Unless governments are committed, unless we as people are choose to be responsible, we cannot make this change. And so it's important for all of us to play a role in this. And again, I think if you follow the numbers, the money, you'll find that America is doing things the right way for the right reasons. And it's because of the stringent manner in which we're being managed.
Okay, so I think we're down to a last question for you for now. So how important is sustainable Hawaii fisheries to your business, to you and your business personally?
Well, I think it's important not just to our business, but to our people here in Hawaii. We're an island state, only island state in a nation. It's always seemed to me that, you know, for people like myself and Guy and Dean Okimoto, farmers, we need to be more sustainable. We need to be more self-sufficient. And that means that we need to be very, very careful about how we do things and the extent to which we utilize our resources. So sustainability in this business to me means that it's a perpetuation of family, communities, lifestyles, diets, and it's part of our culture here in Hawaii. So I think this is very important to remember.
And one thing that I will mention is that in our effort to become more self-sufficient in food production, we do a pretty good job of producing about 25%, 30% of the fish that's or seafood that's eaten in the state here is actually produced here, which is pretty good. What I was saying earlier is across the United States, that's only maybe. It's less than 10% is produced by Americans. The other thing that's important to Hawaii to note is that as much as we are stressing agriculture development and agriculture, agriculture and farming, land-based farming, that wild capture fisheries, harvest fisheries are the highest value food producing system that we have here in Hawaii by far. And it was, in fact, the longline fishery that was mentioned. This is our primary fish that we eat, was worth over $100 million dockside in 2 years ago.
Okay. So here's I'd like to share this with you before I, and it's as we speak, I don't know if you realize that 95 to 98% of the seafood America consumes today is imported, and most of that is cultured. Now, for Hawaii, maybe we import about 70,000. I mean, it's much less, and the 70%. And the reason for that is because of this fleet that we have. We do appreciate what this longline fleet does for us.
That's great. Thank you, Brooks. I'm going to switch over and start talking to or ask questions of Guy Tomashiro. So, Guy, can you please tell us a little bit about the types of and sources of seafood that you have available at the Tomashiro Market?
Okay. We pride ourselves on having good quality and a great selection. If at all possible, we want to get it live, you know, like live Maine lobsters, live Samoan crab, live Dungeness crab, live blue crab, live island taco, live Hawaiian prawns. But we also have to count, well, actually, we also look at getting fresh if at all possible. Sometimes live is not possible. We want to do fresh. Like recently, we started getting fresh scallops from the East Coast, fresh scallops from Hokkaido. Last year, we just started some fresh soft shell crab, and some of them, when they actually came in, were actually still wiggling, so that was kind of great. Last week, we were offered some fresh, tenderized abalone steaks. So we brought a few in. I bought some, wasn't feeling too well, and they went in my freezer, so I got to try that later. But we try different things, and wild and cultured. Wild, I prefer wild shrimp because of the taste and texture, but farm fish, oh, that's a necessity. You have farm fish that tend to be fatty, like Atlantic salmon, you have bluefin ahi, hamachi. The New Zealand king salmon is amazing, the amount of fat content in that. And that's one of the beauty about seafood. You know, not too many foods that you can eat that taste really good are good for you. And that's because of the omega-3s and the fatty parts of the fish.
It's making me hungry. Okay. So I got to ask you a question about your customers.
Mm-hmm.
So in your opinion, what's going through the minds of the heads of your customers when they're making a decision on what to buy?
Well, I think most of them come in with a preconceived notion of what they want to get. You know, like whether it's a bluefin ahi or akule or akupoke, or, you know, they kind of have certain things they look for. But then there are others that, hey, let's go see what the catch of the day is. What's a good deal? You know, hey, akule is a good price today. Let's get some akule. You know, so each customer has their own thing that they come in for. And, you know, it's good to have an open mind, you know, see what's available that day, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you're right back to hunting in the market for the best deal.
Yep, that's my job.
So I got to ask you, do you think that your customers are thinking about the sustainability of the product?
The question doesn't come up very often, but I think for a lot of them, you know, it is in the back of their mind because, you know, they want not just to eat it now. They don't want to be hurting the resource, and I think they want it for their future generations. So I think it is in the back of their minds.
But then again, I'm frequently asked about recommending a reputable seafood dealer. I always tease Guy, but I always send them over to Tomashiro Market.
Good choice.
So bottom line is your customers trust you to
I
do
think
the
so.
Right thing, right? I mean, we're getting to the point of restaurants, stores. People expect them to have done the right thing and got done responsible sourcing of good quality, but sustainable products. That's expected. I'm not sure if it's happening all the time. Okay. So what kind of information do you provide to your customers to help them know about the fish in the retail case?
Okay. Well, the country of origin, if it's not from the United States, and sometimes we have, you know, helpful hints, you know, like say for the king crab, how long to boil it, you know, or like the Hokkaido scallops, if you're going to eat it raw, we found that just by playing around with it, you just add a little bit of salt, and it brings out the sweetness even more. So, you know, just little hints here and there, or information, for example, about our Ora King salmon, which is a New Zealand king salmon, and how an outstanding job that they do. I mean, I think they said it's like 90-something percent water as opposed to a few percent of fish. And my supplier, I was talking to him last week, and he said, yep, I went to the farm, and he looked in the water and says, where's the fish? You know, and it just shows how good a job that they do. No overcrowding.
We're taking our timing cues. We got to move on so we can get to other questions. So I'm going to direct some questions to Ron. So Ron, I understand that tilapia is now one of the top three of type of seafood eaten in the United States market. You think that's the same for Hawaii?
We're getting there, but we have a ways to go. Looking at the first at the U.S. mainland, it's been a steady climb. 20, 30 years ago, tilapia was unknown on the mainland, and we were the ones that knew it. But it's steadily come up, and now is the top white-fleshed seafood consumed in America, behind, with the top two being shrimp and salmon. Locally, it's a harder sell. My wife and I began doing tilapia in the mid-80s in Punalulu Valley and ultimately moving to the North Shore. And for the first 20, 25 years, we focused on live sales to Chinatown, primarily to the Filipino population that was familiar with the fish and appreciated quality and freshness, so the market was for live fish. In 2009, we collaborated with Chef Alan Wong and his team and began really trying to ramp up the image of tilapia. I mean, first we had to prove the quality of tilapia through a series of taste tests initially at the farmers, the annual Hawaii Farm Fair, and against wild caught mahi-mahi, and we did well there for, I think, 3 years, and then we started doing taste tests at Allen's restaurant in the Farmer Series dinners. And so little by little, I think we have made inroads into the perception that tilapia is simply an alawai fish. It's like any fish, it's what it eats and where it grows, and how you care for it. For the past, last year, we began also selling fish to 53 by the Sea with Chef Josh, and so that is going well, and we just hope to keep focusing on quality and getting that reputation change in place. We won't make the top three, but I think my goal is to get to the top five.
Here. So I've heard very positive things about your variety, your brand of tilapia. What makes your tilapia different from tilapia commonly found in the American market?
The majority of the tilapia that come in the American market right now are from China, but also Indonesia. And on the east coast of the U.S., they bring in through the port of Miami from Central and South America. The fish in China primarily are intensely cultured in earthen ponds. In Indonesia, it's more cage culture, but again, very intensely cultured. And there are less strict regulations on the use of antibiotics and other treatments. We made a commitment 30 years ago not to use antibiotics on our farm or hormones or anything else. We are fortunate to have a spring-fed water source, and we raise the fish in floating cages in 50 to 100 feet of water with the fish in the top 4 feet, so they've never seen mud. They don't know what mud is or tastes like. And then we invest in the best feed we can buy. And by having good feed, we ensure the health without having to go the route of antibiotics.
So the food and the water ends up being a better, and the variety that you have is a better product. So thank you very much for those questions. So I'm going to open it to the public for a couple, or to the group for a couple questions. You have a hand up right there.
Sorry, once again, just to the point of the quality of the water leads to a better product. I grew up on Long Island myself. I was fishing, eeling, crabbing, clamming out in the bay. They just started a project a few years ago of reseeding Jamaica Bay, which is a massive national park, actually. And that is actually the shellfish are, of course, now cleaning the bay just as they used to. And that will, of course, lead to not only better water, but a better product for you guys as well. So can't go wrong with shellfish, right?
Yeah. I don't think this is working, but I think I could talk loud enough. That's called the Billion Oyster Project.
Right.
I'll be back there. They have an annual big feast. I'll go back next month. They're doing a great job there because, again, it's not just they need clean water. The shellfish, what I love about it is shellfish are part of a well-functioning estuary. You don't, if there's not enough filter feeders in a bay, you can have problems as well. So I think a lot of people are discovering that, especially on the East Coast where a lot of populations have been, you know, devastated over years, like in Chesapeake Bay and in New York Harbor. So great book called The Big Oyster if you want to read about the history of oysters in New York Harbor.
That was a good one. Any other questions out there?
I have a question. You didn't mention the aquaculture that's grown out on Kona as a percentage of your. What is the role of that kind of farmed fish?
Kona, what any?
They you know, kampachi,
Anyone, are you talking about?
They grow kampachi, octopus. I just ate some shrimp that time supermarket was selling for $7.99 a pound. It was delicious. It's raised right with the deep water. Do you know anything about that?
There's also two oyster hatcheries out there as well. You're talking about the Nela site.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't know the name of that place.
Yeah, there's.
But no, it's such a broad question. But there's a variety of different aquaculture operations that are there at Keohole at the Nelha facility, and then some commercially. And they are the kampachi that you mentioned is grown in offshore cages, but they're still within state waters, I believe. I think we're still having issues with permitting offshore in federal water. So hopefully we can get some relief on that and work those things out so that we can start growing in the open ocean also.
Most of the aquaculture feed mills in the U.S. and some of the major producers overseas are constantly improving the feeds. The challenge is to get the right protein levels at a price that produces a fish that's both healthy and affordable. There's constant movement towards addressing those concerns. I think some of the major players like Cargill and Purina, EWOS from the Netherlands, are actively proceeding in that. We're looking at algaes as a source of proteins. We're looking at using the fish cleaning, the uneaten part of the fish, like from Tamashiro's, converting that into feed for fish. This is a worldwide effort to address this because we have to solve this in order to grow more seafood. And it's just figuring out the best way to do it. So it's a constant progression of science working with industry to move forward.
I think we have time for one more question.
Mahalo for your guys' presentation this evening. It's been excellent, the facts that you've provided. My question was with regard to the auction that takes place. There was a specific mention that farm-raised fish were not part of the auction stuff. And I'm just trying to figure out how it is that we can bring farm-raised fish into that same scenery to allow for that same kind of competition. Or is it that if you're doing farm-raised, you have to go out and sort of find your own market?
Well, for the auction, the thing is that it really depends on how much product that we're talking about as well. And so for me, or for us, really, we look at what's in the best interest of the grower. And if it's not necessarily in the best interest of the grower to come through the auction system, because you pay a 10%, you know, you pay us 10% for selling your product. So in many cases, there have been situations where I've suggested the grower go straight to, like, a retailer-like guy, because it's in their best interest, collective best interest, I think, in terms of the success factor and all of that, and freshness of the product and that sort of thing. So it's not that we wouldn't do that. It's, I think, in the best interest of the grower, I think it's important to look at what the basic economics itself are.
Thanks, Brooks. Let me jump in here, because I think the example is right here with John Finger from Hog Island. He's a grower, and he sells it directly to the public through his restaurants. So that is called vertical integration. He's not going to send his product all the way out to into the seafood distribution market. And so I think the same thing goes for Ron. Ron has a special product. He's a farmer, and I got to say, I'm imagining he's got some time, but to go market his fish and get the best price for it. So I think that's probably the best reason, the most reason why it's aquaculture fish not going through the auction. And then fishermen is the opposite, right? They're fishing all day, or all day for days and days and days. The last thing you want to do is come back and try to sell that fish.
I want to thank the panel. You know, in addition to being the executive director of the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation, I'm also timekeeper, because I've known these guys for a really long time, and they can talk about fish forever. And my job is to keep us all on track. So anyway, thank you again for being here. Please give our speakers one more round of applause. Appreciate them coming out. We have the eating and drinking portion now, and it's on the fifth floor of the Swell Deck, Swell Bar. Our lineup of chefs are David Lukela from Alohilani Resort, and he has actually shucked about 500 oysters, 1,000 oysters for you, 1,000 oysters for you tonight. We have oysters from Hog Island Oyster, as well as oysters from Kualoa Ranch, and I saw John Morgan here, so thank you for donating those oysters. And I also have to say a mahalo to Tropics Fish and Roy's Restaurants, because it took a lot for us to get the oysters flown here, so thank you. We also have Joshua Getz from 53 by the Sea, Jake Saito from Strip Steak, and Bao Tran from Mi Alameda Cantina and the Street Food Hall by Michael Mina. Last but not least, I have to thank our Eat, Think, Drink, Beverage, Cup, and Plateware sponsors, Fiji Water, Southern Glazers Wine and Spirits, Anheuser-Busch, Tossware, and Viterra. We hope you stay connected and continue the conversation about what you learned this evening. I want to put in one more plug for another event that we have coming up, and it's a sister organization that I run called Hawaii Food and Wine Festival. We have more than 100 chefs, winemakers, and mixologists coming in October, but we have our launch at the Kahala Resort and at KCC Kaikena. We are featuring different chefs, and our culinary hero this year is Chef Rick Bayless, who was the first Top Chef Master winner, as well as a 7-time James Beard Award winner. So I hope you can join us. Our tickets are on sale at HawaiiFoodAndWineFestival.com. Thank you very much. We hope you enjoy the rest of the evening.